how software is developed and deployed in banking is changing a lot. And I don't think regulators have nearly kept up with the risk that that can incur, particularly sort of customer-facing risk.
Hello, and welcome to the Banking and Payment Show, a Behind the Numbers podcast from eMarketer, sponsored by Wells Fargo. Today is December 8th. I'm Rob Rubin, GM of Financial Services here at Insider Intelligence, and your host. This is our seventh episode of this new series, Lucky Seven. If you enjoy this podcast, please give us a five-star rating and subscribe. In today's episode, we'll first look at some headlines about regulators' interest in fintechs, banking as a service provider specifically, in our segment called The Headlines. In our Story by Numbers segment, we selected a few numbers that highlight the demand of and the need for regulatory oversight. Our final segment today is called Pretend CCO, stands for Chief Compliance Officer. And our guest today is going to pretend he's the CCO of a fintech, and he's going to lay out his top priorities in 2023, given potential new regulatory scrutiny. Today, I invited Jason Mikula to join us for this episode. Jason is the managing director of 312 Global Strategies, a consulting firm focused on financial services product strategy, go-to-market, marketing, regulation, and compliance, as well as the publisher of FinTech Weekly, one of my regular reads. He's going to come talk to us today about the challenges banking as a service providers and their partners face as regulators are beginning to pay more attention to them as entities and also more attention to the bank's relationships with these third parties. Hey, Jason, how you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. Thanks for having me.
I'm really glad to have you, and this is a really exciting topic for us to talk about. Before we jump into it, quickly, there's a lot of behind-the-scenes things that go on to facilitate a banking transaction like a deposit or a payment. And I just wanted to set the table so that everybody can sort of understand some of the complexity. It starts with the banking license. There has to be a license behind the transaction. There's recording and reporting the transaction, ensuring it satisfies the compliance requirements of the regulatory bodies where the transaction occurred. And let's not forget about anti-money laundering, fraud, risk management. I think you all get the idea. It's really complicated. And banking as a service provides these behind-the-scenes complicated services so fintechs and brands can offer banking services quickly and at scale through APIs. And neobanks are great examples of fintechs leveraging banking as a service. Chime, a top neobank in the U.S., uses Galileo's banking as a service offering for all those things mentioned above, and Galileo's partnership with the Bancorp provides Chime with the banking license required to accept deposits. So, Jason, who does Chime use for credit products, and why do they use different banks?
That's an excellent question, and even the phrase banking as a service is a relatively recent creation, right? So these kinds of partnerships between banks and non-bank entities have existed for a long time. And you've had major players in the space like the Bancorp Bank that you mentioned, also MetaBank, which recently renamed as Pathward, Green Dot, which only recently became a bank, played in this space of leveraging banking relationships to provide certain kinds of services. It's increasingly common for these consumer-facing fintechs, so like Chime that you mentioned, to rely on multiple banking partners to be able to operate the products that they're offering, right? So in Chime's case, Galileo is technically what's known as an issuer processor. And the role that plays is connecting a card network like Visa or MasterCard to the underlying bank. So in Chime's case, there are actually two underlying bank partners it works with to hold deposits and to issue debit cards. And that is Bancorp, which you mentioned, as well as Stride Bank. And then on the credit side, in Chime's case, it's a credit builder card.
Is that like a second chance or just like a credit building to get your credit rating?
It's akin to a secured card, although the way that Chime does it is somewhat novel, but the idea is to help build your credit history, improve your credit score, and Chime works with Stride as the issuer, the BIN sponsor. BIN is bank identification number sponsor of that card. So you'll see that there are, in Chime's case, issuer processor, multiple banks. It's not uncommon for the consumer-facing fintech to have multiple partners behind the scenes to actually build and operate these products.
That's great. And this gets us right into our first segment, The Headlines. Our first headline is about whether the FTX collapse will lead to better crypto regulation. And this is an article that was in The New Yorker, and it focuses in on the different regulators trying to keep up with crypto. The article really focused on crypto as being a digital asset regulated like a security from the SEC. But what I think is interesting with respect to this conversation is all of the behind-the-scenes banking services offered by FTX through BaaS. And my question really is, will the collapse of FTX impact regulations on BaaS providers and the bank license holders?
So this gets a little bit complicated, but I guess that shouldn't be surprising if we're talking about FTX and the sort of fallout that's happening in the crypto space.
Yeah.
Everything with that company seems to be a bit convoluted. I mean, I think it's important to point out that there are different banking capabilities that FTX or any crypto company relies on as part of operating their business in the US, right? So all of them need some kind of fiat currency on and off ramp. And that's basically a payment processing capability to allow FTX to accept US dollar denominated funds from their customers and make them available on the platform to buy Bitcoin or Ether or whatever. And conversely, if a customer sells Bitcoin, to take that money back off FTX into their whatever Wells Fargo account. Now, FTX had a couple of other things they were doing. One, they offered a debit card that would allow users to spend funds directly out of their FTX account. And two, they also had this sort of direct deposit capability that allowed users to send a portion of their paycheck or some other recurring deposit directly into their FTX account. And those are a bit discreet. You also have BlockFi, which is sort of caught up in this whole thing, declared bankruptcy recently, that offered a credit card program with Bitcoin rewards. So you have a lot of sort of different capabilities, all of which require a bank partner. Now, to address your specific question, do I think you're going to see a specific change to regulation driven by this? I think probably not, at least not in the near term. I think what will happen is increased regulatory scrutiny to understand for the bank partners that were facilitating these capabilities, you know, what kind of due diligence, what kind of ongoing monitoring were they doing of their partners? You know, how did FTX get to bankruptcy? How did BlockFi get to bankruptcy? And these banks need to abruptly shut down card programs without them sort of knowing. Did they have the right system in place to monitor and mitigate these risks?
Were their partners had the right governance and oversight of what they were doing? I mean, that's what
Correct.
I would think regulators are going to want to know is, why didn't you know this was going on?
And we've seen this a couple of months ago with another bank in the space, Blue Ridge, a question of how did you decide to work with these firms in the first place? When you were making the decision, sure, we'll do a debit card with FTX, or sure, we'll offer a credit card with BlockFi, what diligence did you do then? And how did you arrive at the decision that this was an appropriate partnership to engage in?
Can you see the conversation? Well, we were in the Bahamas and I was at the beach and we were talking about it.
You're joking, but reading some of the reports that have come out from whatever his name is, John J. Ray, it sounds like there were borderline no proper systems, accounting controls in place. I participated on sort of both sides of these partnerships a number of years ago. Part of building those programs is reviewing compliance management systems, documents, personnel, controls. And I struggle to imagine how that actually happened with FTX, given it sounds like they had very few.
Right. And you would think that a bank partner would go in saying, hang on, you don't have the controls. So obviously that's a gap for the regulators to poke at. Our second headline is a piece you wrote a few months ago in FinTech Weekly about OCC's 2023 supervision plan, which includes FinTech, BaaS, crypto, climate focus. And for those who are listening, the OCC stands for the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency. I love that. They regulate national bank charters. So the OCC is worried about deposits. They're worried about checking and debit. They're worried about fraud, AML. What are they going to focus on? What do you think is their top focus as they start to think about these priorities?
At the most sort of abstract or highest level, what the OCC cares about and other interrelated regulators, particularly the FDIC, what they care about is the safety and soundness of the banking sector. I mean, to link it back to what we were just talking about, making sure if there's a FTX, like if there's a bank collapse, that we don't see that have a contagion effect and cause sort of ricochet through the banking system.
Right, a run on the banks.
Exactly. And that's why you have prudential regulation, meaning are you managing your risk prudently? That's why you have deposit insurance and the sort of cost or assessment that goes along with that. So what is the OCC looking at? They're looking at are banks that are engaging in partnerships, third-party partnerships, whether that's with a relatively vanilla neobank like Chime or something a little bit more risk on like banking with a crypto exchange, do they have the proper diligence and controls in place to mitigate the risk that's tied to that activity? So I think the areas you're going to see, and the OCC hasn't been subtle about this in the speeches that Michael Hsu, head of the OCC, has given in the past couple of months, they're going to be looking at due diligence, what ongoing oversight looks like, particularly as it relates to BSA, which is the Bank Secrecy Act, and AML compliance. Sanctions compliance is top of mind, given what's going on with Russia. And also, weirdly, I guess we're going easy on Venezuela now, I guess.
Yeah.
KYC, KYB, transaction monitoring, but also technology risk and controls.
Right.
How software is developed and deployed in banking is changing a lot. And I don't think regulators have nearly kept up with the risk that that can incur, particularly sort of customer facing risk.
Just out of curiosity, well, not really curiosity, I'm just asking, which regulatory bodies in the UK and the EU have similar remits? And are they ahead or behind the OCC?
To put it simply, I would say in a lot of regards ahead. So the US banking system is very bizarre in the sense you really have two. You have a state level system with state regulators issuing licenses and the federal system, and then some components that deal with both, again, particularly the FDIC and then also the CFPB in regards to consumer protection. So it can be slow moving and also sometimes have some inconsistencies across jurisdictions and regulators. In the UK and the EU, it's easier to get a banking license. So Monzo, Starling, and 26, they all have regular full banking licenses. And there's also the existence of sort of novel license categories. So the idea of an e-money institution or a payments institution, these ideas don't exist in the American banking license landscape. And so they've been a little bit quicker to create new categories to facilitate the kinds of companies and the kinds of activities that have developed in the past 5-10 years.
Right. And I see in the US, all of the regulatory bodies are establishing innovation teams, but I think that that's all sort of trying to catch up.
Regulators tend to be slow moving and respond to things that have already happened, right? I mean, what is the phrase? You know, never waste a good crisis. 2007, 2008 gave rise to Dodd-Frank, gave rise to CFPB. Will this current crypto crisis give rise to some sort of meaningful change in regulation? Maybe, maybe not. A lot of that depends on Congress, which, I mean, don't hold your breath.
Right, I agree. It leads us to our next segment, which is called Story by Numbers. Here, we've selected two numbers that really highlight why fintechs, BaaS providers, and their holding partners are undergoing more regulatory scrutiny. So let's start with the first number. We broke these out. We're calling them the opportunity and the risk. So the first number is the opportunity number, and it is $2.3 billion in 2022, growing to $5.4 billion in 2024. And those numbers are the banking as a service revenue in 2022 and 2024, respectively, based on our eMarketer forecasts. BaaS providers charge fees in different ways, right? This is basically fee revenue from their partners. They charge for API calls from customers. They have subscription models. And revenue growth for banking as a service providers means that lots of fintechs and brands are providing banking and payment services to lots of consumers. So my question is less about regulation, though it's related. Given the fee revenue, do you think that the fintech and bank license holders are going to start squeezing the BaaS providers, that middle group, by handling more of the BaaS stack?
Yeah, so I think that's a really interesting question. I mean, one of the main value propositions of the platforms that we've been discussing is that their case is that they facilitate getting to market more quickly and less expensively. Whether you're a fintech where your whole sort of business is a financial product, or you're some kind of brand that wants to embed that, having to go and deal with the bank directly, it's hard, it's complicated, it's time consuming, ergo, it's expensive. I think the potential risk in some of the BaaS platform's business model is as companies that use them scale, it can become increasingly attractive to move off the BaaS platform and build that direct relationship.
Right.
So you have some sort of built-in churn risk there. To address your question more specifically, one school of thought sort of argues that these BaaS platforms are a band-aid. They're needed because your existing banks, pardon my language, but like generally kind of suck at doing technology, right?
Not mainframe technology. They're good at the mainframe technology.
COBOL.
Yeah.
If I knew COBOL, I'd be rich. The idea is that the BaaS platform abstracts the complexity of dealing with this old, antiquated mainframe, maybe COBOL system that a lot of legacy banks use. It doesn't help that the majority of the banks playing in this BaaS space have less than $10 billion in assets. They're smaller banks, and that's because they're exempt from something called the Durbin Amendment, meaning debit card swipes are more profitable. So they tend to be smaller banks, often located not necessarily in San Francisco or New York. So maybe they have a harder time attracting technical talent. The idea being, okay, you add this BaaS layer on top of it, it makes it easier for fintechs or brands to launch products, and they sort of collect these tolls or fees in the middle. Now, the counter argument is maybe this is just a temporary thing because the banks, like a bank corp, maybe weren't so good at technology, but now you're getting the rise of native bank platforms like Piermont, which launched, I think, within the last couple of years, like Cross River Bank in New Jersey, like Column, which was co-founded by one of the gentlemen from Plaid. And these will sort of be API-first, tech-first banks that get rid of the need for this BaaS layer. Now, the flip side of that argument is there's a benefit to working with a platform that has multiple banks underneath. So instead of building a one-to-one relationship with Piermont, I work with a platform that has 2, 3, 4, 10 banks that they work with. And as a fintech, that gives me flexibility in what products am I offering? What bank partner am I using to build them? It gives me some redundancy. So if one of those banks has a regulatory problem, I can more easily shift to a second one. I guess I'm not really answering your question other than to say, we don't really know. There's a bit of flux right now.
Right.
And some of that is going to be determined by what happens with regulation in 2023 and beyond.
Right. And I wonder, sort of with that, do you think that regulators might make it too onerous for third parties to handle certain parts of the BaaS stack? In other words, they're going to put such sort of regulatory oversight on the bank license holders. Banks are going to have to do certain things that they are giving to third parties today themselves. And I wonder if that's the case, does that then take the small bank player who's trying to do this out of the equation and it goes back to the banks that have some scale?
You know, I think the more likely impact is to be a limitation on the number of programs any given bank can support, right?
Yeah.
If you're getting feedback from whatever your relevant regulator is, like, hey, we don't think you have the right systems or personnel in place to support 40 fintech programs, but we think you can support 10 with adequate oversight.
Okay.
So I think in the near term, you're going to see either explicit, and this happened with Blue Ridge with their consent order with the OCC, they cannot onboard any more programs without the OCC signing off, right? So you've seen it like in practice already.
They're on the naughty list. That's what we call it.
Exactly. So near term, I think you're going to see some hesitancy to sort of scale up without making sure resources are adequate and basically throwing bodies, throwing compliance personnel to try to solve that problem. Medium to longer term, I think you're going to see more compliance regulatory tech that attempts to solve some of these problems with technology and AI, machine learning, blah, 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 instead of throwing compliance personnel at it.
Okay. Our second number here for Story by Numbers is the risk. And I'm going to put this number, it's a US number, and it's 24 million. And that is the number of neobank account holders in the US. And by the way, Chime, we estimate, has about 18.5 million subscribers. So they are the largest player by far. Can you talk for a few minutes, or maybe just a minute, about some of the risks here and why the regulatory bodies are so concerned?
This is my hobby horse. Anytime you're handling a client's money, a customer's money, it comes with risks and you need to mitigate those risks appropriately. And there are examples in the near past of neobank or prepaid cards that had issues, technology issues that resulted in consumers not being able to access their funds. I mean, Rush Card was sort of the most notorious one, and this was in like 2016. More recently, Chime, because Galileo had a tech issue, customers were unable to access their funds for, I think, about a day or 2 days.
Well, that's a big deal.
Yeah, particularly when users of these products tend to be lower income, higher risk, as far as if they can't get that money, they don't have a lot of other options.
Right.
And so I think the biggest risk is it's not necessarily one of these companies failing, although that could happen or could contribute, but an issue where there's a technology problem or some sort of, you know, transitioning from provider A to provider B, where users are unable to access their money. And the regulators, specifically in this case, CFPB, has made very clear that that is like one of the worst things you can do.
Right. That's a don't go there thing. And that's all the time we have for our story by number segment. Now, let's take a break and hear from our sponsor, Wells Fargo. Wells Fargo is a leading financial service company that proudly serves 1 in 3 U.S. households and more than 10% of small businesses in the U.S. Wells Fargo is proud to provide a diversified set of banking, investment, and mortgage products and services. For the communities we serve, the company focuses on building a sustainable, inclusive future for all by supporting housing affordability, small business growth, financial health, and a low-carbon economy. News, insights, and perspectives from Wells Fargo can be found on stories.wf.com. I'm really excited about our last segment, Pretend CCO. It's our final segment, and it's a slight adaptation from our Pretend CEO segment. It's about being a compliance officer. And Jason, you're going to pretend you're the chief compliance officer of a fintech that relies on BaaS providers. Seeing what's happening in terms of new regulations, what are your priorities going into 2023 as the chief compliance officer?
First of all, priority one is have a chief compliance officer. You know, some of the promise...
Get the job.
Some of the promise of these BaaS platforms, some of them are sort of out there selling a dream of you don't need to have any compliance or minimal compliance because we're going to do that work for you. And I would sort of push back a little bit on that notion that particularly the earliest stage startups, I get why they don't want to hire head of compliance. It's an expensive role. It's a competitive talent market, but it's very difficult. The areas that you don't know about. Right. And so it's easy to sort of accept this promise of like, okay, like the platform and the bank are making sure I don't muck anything up. But the reality is you could be doing something and not even know that it's a problem. A very quick example, let's say you have some intern running marketing and they want to target this credit card offer based on what kind of mobile phone somebody is using, Cricket versus AT&T. Sounds totally innocent, but you could be running into an issue where you're unknowingly discriminating based on a protected class.
Right.
If you can demonstrate like, certain racial groups are more likely to use Verizon versus Cricket or T-Mobile, all of a sudden you have a disparate impact problem.
Right.
And the person running marketing probably doesn't know that. This is why you need a compliance officer, the right staff with the right knowledge and the right processes and controls. Hate to sound like a killjoy.
I know that banks make a marketing offer. It's very regulated as far as how they make the offer, that the offer is not restricted to a particular class.
Exactly. Number two, having a direct relationship with the bank partner. So, you know, we're talking about these different banking as a service platforms. I've heard anecdotally of fintechs that have never met, have never had a conversation with their bank partner. That might sound good in theory, like, oh, banks, they're slow. They're all wearing like suits and ties and I don't want to deal with this stuff. I just want to write code. But the reality is if and when there's a problem, you want to have direct lines of communication to the right people at your bank partner and
right.
not rely on being intermediated by a banking as a service platform. Like you should have relationships with both so that if there's an issue that needs addressing, if there's a problem, if there's a question, you have the right context to do so.
Yep.
And then the last point I made, and we sort of covered this a bit previously, was consider having multiple bank partners. So I think the Blue Ridge story that we've sort of cited a couple times here, if you were a fintech and you were working with Blue Ridge to build your company, build your offering, and all of a sudden, through no fault of your own, your bank partner gets this consent order that says, hey, before you can build or launch any new product, you need to get the regulator to sign off. All of a sudden, that's a major roadblock in your plans as a fintech because now your bank partner is hamstrung in what they can and cannot do or whose sign off they need.
Right.
So whether it's the relationship without the middleware, without the banking as a service platform, or with that platform, having multiple bank partners helps to mitigate risk, particularly as you start to get larger. I mean, another quick anecdote there, there was a sort of savings-oriented startup fintech called HM Bradley, and I believe they basically attracted so many customers and customer deposits that their bank partners had to say, hey, you need to sort of slow this down because it's going to sort of
mess up their balance sheet.
Yes, exactly. It's going to sort of mess up our ability to manage our deposit base and our assets versus our liabilities. So Right. Like the company, HM Bradley, actually had to go back to an invite-only mode as a constraint of their bank partners. So sort of managing that risk and understanding when's the right time to take on additional bank partners and what is the right or most efficient way to go about doing that. Those would be my three.
I just have a question on that. When they have a savings product, fintech is out offering a savings product that has a rate. Mm-hmm. Who's paying the rate? Like the cost of funds, the rate, that's really the bank, right? Like the bank's the one that has to decide if they can make money giving you a certain deposit rate. Like how does the fintech decide? The fintech doesn't hold the balance sheet.
So that can vary sort of contract to contract or bank partner to bank partner. A fintech can choose essentially to subsidize or pay a higher rate as essentially a marketing device, right? So let's say you had an arrangement where your bank partner says, okay, Fed funds went up, we're going to offer 2.5% on deposits. But if you want to compete with, oh, Goldman's offering 3 or like Capital One's offering 3, let's offer 3.10. The fintech could basically pay the difference so that it could use that APY as a marketing hook.
Okay. But that doesn't add risk to the balance sheet of the banking partner because they're the ones that have to pay it.
No, I mean, in the example I gave, let's say you had a contractual arrangement where the bank is going to pay some amount below whatever the Fed funds rate is. Uh-huh. What the bank is on the hook for is presumably static and determined by contract. And then if there's sort of a sweetener on top of that, the fintech could be basically subsidizing what that rate is.
And I guess where compliance and regulatory issues come into play here is that there have to be assurances that the fintech has the money.
To actually pay it.
Because if they don't have the money, the bank has to pay it, right?
Yeah, I mean, that would come down to, I think, Reg DD and Truth in Savings Disclosure. Yeah. So it's like, if you say you're paying 3%, you better be able to pay 3%. And if 2.5 is coming from the bank and 50 bips is coming from the fintech,
you better have it.
You're right. It's on the bank to make sure that the fintech has money in their own balance sheet to cover that cost.
Well, this was great today. Thanks, Jason.
Thank you so much for having me.
I look forward to having you on again and again and again. This was so much fun. I want to also thank everyone for listening to the Banking and Payment Show, an eMarketer podcast sponsored by Wells Fargo. And also thank you to our editor, Todd. In today's episode, Jason and I review data from our forecasts and the report, The Bank in 2025, and clients can go online to review right away. And future clients, please visit insiderintelligence.com for more information. We also referenced an article from The New Yorker about the FTX collapse, as well as Jason's article in FinTech Weekly on the OCC and new regulations. Our next episode is on December 20th, and you'll not want to miss it.